This is a recording from the Jefferson Literary and Debating Society at the University of Virginia. For more information, visit www.jeffersonsociety.org. On October 19, 2007, Dr. Stuart Davies of Harvard University addressed the Society on his work on tropical ecology and plant taxonomy. Davies has spent much of his career studying the long-term effects of environmental stresses on the rainforests.
All right, thanks, Amro, and thanks very much for inviting me to speak. I think you'll see that I think it was worth the wait in terms of seeing the images and seeing some of the... Can you see over there? Yep. I think it'll be worth it to see the images and see some of the work that we do in tropical forests worldwide. And today, this evening, what I want to talk to you about is a program that I run, which is concerns tropical rainforests worldwide, and particularly to sort of have a look at how we are addressing issues to do with climate change and loss of tropical rainforests and what it might mean for people in the rest of the world. So tropical rainforests, as you may know, are the repositories of an enormous amount of biodiversity. They span the tropic to tropics in the world. They include some of the most extraordinary organisms. Here's one of the rhinoceros hornbills from Borneo, a place where I've spent a lot of time working. These, in many other parts of the tropics, chimpanzees, orangutans, and all the major organisms live in these forests. In addition, there are lots and lots of little animals of various kinds, a gecko in a forest in Malaysia, for example, an extraordinary diversity of invertebrates, such as these caterpillars, which we've reared in an experiment we're doing in Thailand. And these are some of the great diversity. Something like 70% of the biodiversity of the globe is in the tropics. And the tropics only account for something like 8% of the land surface area. Next, please. Lots and lots of beautiful, beautiful plants. And I noticed one of your members has brought in an orchid, which you might like to look at later, from this part of the world as well. Next, please. So as I said, 70% of global biodiversity occurs in this extraordinary habitat. These forests often are very, very tall. They can be up to 70 meters in height. They have lots and lots of what we call niches, where different kinds of organisms can live and thereby coexist. Next, please. They also store, tropical rainforests store, something like 50% of terrestrial carbon. Carbon makes up about 50% of a tree, if you're wondering. And rainforests, less than 10% of the surface area of the Earth, account for something like 50% of terrestrial carbon. So if we're concerned about issues of climate change, then we should be concerned about what's happening to rainforests. Next, please. Rainforests also do a lot of other important things. The Amazon here, a photo from above the Amazon, looking at the early morning mist, and this is a very important part of regulating the climates in the world in total, but in the tropics in particular. Rainforests also do a bunch of other very important things for us. They control the hydrology of the planet. The Amazon cycles some extraordinary proportion, something like 30% of the water that is in the terrestrial biome. When we mess with that system, we end up with droughts, we end up with floods, and these floods can be extremely costly to human life, they can be extremely costly to infrastructure. And forests, when they're left alone, can regulate the hydrology of the planet effectively. But forests are also important reservoirs of products that we like to use. And this is an example of some African mahoganies that have been logged out of the central Congo or eastern Congo. And this is it's been a very important resource. It was a very important resource for North America and Australia, but it's also an important resource for people who live in the tropics and who are going through processes of economic development. By the way, I don't mind if you interrupt during my talk. I'm just speaking as things come to my mind. So if you have a question about something of biology, I know there are not too many biologists in here. So if you have questions, I don't know how the system works, but you're more than welcome just to click your fingers or whatever and stop me and stamp your foot or do whatever you do. But forests. Timber's not the only important thing that people get out of rainforests. They get a whole range of medicinal and food plants and all kinds of organisms that they use, particularly in indigenous communities. And this is one of the flowers the biggest flowers in the world. Actually, these are the buds of that flower. It grows in Malaysia. And the local Orang Asli, we call them, the native Aborigines in this forest, collect these buds before the flower opens up, and they use it for medicinal purposes. And there are many, many examples of people that extract nuts and fruits and animals, and some of them for very, apparently to us, dubious purposes, such as aphrodisiacs and things like that. But nevertheless, it's an important reservoir of these products. Next, please. Tropical forests also, and this is something I put up for debate, since that's where we are. They have an extraordinary aesthetic appeal to many people. And this becomes an important issue when we're trying to understand the value of tropical forests and the concern that people have about conservation versus utilization. Next, please. So these forests are functioning and they're very effective at doing what they do, and we use them in many, 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 many ways. But humans are impacting the global environment in some very, very substantial ways. That is greatly impacting the ability of forests, not just in the tropics, but in the temperate zone as well, to provide this set of what we call ecosystem goods and services, which I just mentioned. We know very well from all kinds of information that the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere over the last 300 years has increased by 30%. In the last 40 years, it's gone up by 15%. And we know from basic principles in science that that is likely to have a big impact on forests and on other ecosystems. There's been a 50% increase in atmospheric methane. The ones in red I'm going to talk more about in the latter part of my talk. Can I take my water?
Sure.
Thanks. We have now increased the terrestrial fixation of gaseous nitrogen. Nitrogen is fixed by things like legumes naturally, but humans now fix it for the purposes of things like fertilizer production. We've doubled the total nitrogen that's fixed in the atmosphere, and many of you heard about nitrogen pollution, particularly in Europe. We've transformed something like 50% of the ice-free land surface into agricultural and urban systems, impacting the ability of ecosystems to do what I was talking about. We lose in the tropics alone something like 10 million hectares of forest every year, converted to agriculture or converted to other uses. And we do lots of other things to other ecosystems, which I'm not going to talk too much more about. We harvest fish that use something like, this is well out of date, this number. It's more like 15% of total ocean productivity. We take the fish out of the system. We use something like 54% of the total available fresh water in the world, and we suffer on account of that. And this number is, particularly places like China with these burgeoning populations, these numbers are going to increase dramatically. And we do something very important, like that orchid which is sitting over there, as we transport species across national boundaries all the time, and it has the potential to greatly impact our ecosystems, invasive species being the big example. Next, please. And we, in the tropics, although we as humans like the products of tropical rainforests, we take them at unsustainable levels. And this is an example from Malaysia, a project I work on, where we're looking to try and understand why and how people take these excessive amounts of timber. Next. People also encroach into parks which are protected in the tropics. Most of these, of course, there are reasons why people do this. They need to do this. They have reasons. They want to grow rice. In this case, they are wanting to grow rubber plantations. They're not planted yet. But this is in southern China, another site we work, where they're encroaching into what is one of the few remaining national parks in that part of southern China. Next. Throughout the tropics, but the Amazon is the best example, the building of roads, these kind of roads, create a real, what they sometimes refer to as a fishbone pattern of deforestation, where once a road is built, then communities move in and start agriculture, and these things through time leave a very, very patchwork environment. And this is what we call habitat fragment or forest fragmentation. You get these little patches of forest which are isolated, and we want to know, well, can those kinds of patches of forest survive? Will they lose their species, their important species? And I'll talk more about this later. once people move into these areas, an example from my own work in Southeast Asia, looking at landscapes, once these roads have been cut, once the trees have been removed, then there's a great influx of people, and these ecosystems never revert, at least in the time frame we're looking at, never revert to anything like a natural system. Now, natural forest, fully functional forest system, these are shifting cultivation areas, rice plantations, followed by other vegetable crops and things. Next. And forest fires, once those systems get fragmented, once those systems get degraded, forest fires become a very important part of the ecology. Forest fires don't normally invade tropical rainforests. Wet tropical rainforest is immune naturally to fire. But once these roads get built and fragmentation occurs, then fires become an important part. And that obviously excludes lots and lots of things. Next. I'll give you one example from a colleague of mine's work, which shows how forest fragmentation can... This is the dissection of an otherwise intact piece of forest. How forest fragmentation can impact the ability of a forest to function, as ecologists would say, to function properly. This is an area in western Borneo, southwestern Borneo, Kalimantan, Indonesian Borneo, where the national park, this yellow band here, that delineates the national park. In the space of 20 years, or not even, 14 years, the red is deforestation. And this area of West Kalimantan, it was all about a transmigration program that the national government had, moving people in. And this led to an extraordinary rate of deforestation. Next slide. So this Lisa Curran, she's at Yale, the person who did this work, she was monitoring the trees in this forest through that period. And this is just, in green here, is the number of fruits that are produced in each of these fruiting events. The trees are producing lots and lots of fruits. The black are whether or not the proportion of the green, which are viable seeds. And what she's found in the most recent flowering events, so this is continuing on, is that the trees are not producing viable seeds. And the reason for that, she thinks, is that because the forest is heavily fragmented, the predators that eat the seeds have become super abundant in these remaining fragments. And so there's basically the ability for these trees to regenerate is going to, in the future, we think, going to be severely impacted. Yes, yeah, please, Amaro. Go back one, yeah. Yeah, that's a good question. And those of you, the astute ones, will notice that this is not, you know, you think of trees in this part of the world, they flower every year, typically during the summer or the spring. In this part of the world, in Borneo, there's no dry season. It's wet all year round. And trees don't flower every year. There's no annual flowering event. You could go out and see all the trees flowering. But actually what happens is these ENSO events, maybe you've heard of ENSO events, these El Nino events that happen. It's called El Nino Southern Oscillation. They happen on something like 5 to 8 year cycles. And when these things come, they cause a very severe drought. And the trees are cued into this and they flower. And so we don't know. This was a weak ENSO event apparently. So it didn't push flowering very high. But it's an interesting story in itself. Okay, now I come to my own project, or the project which I'm looking after. Those first series of slides were just a sort of general introduction to what I see as some of the big issues and some of the problems that we face. So 25 years ago, my colleagues, not me, particularly two professors, one at Harvard and one then at Princeton, initiated a program to try to understand how tropical forests function, understanding that those impacts, the extraction, the fragmentation, the forest loss, are all happening apace. They wanted to understand, well, how do we understand that scientifically so we can monitor and we can model and we can change the behavior of people. And so what they did is they went to Barra Colorado Island, which is in the Panama Canal. This is an island that was created when they formed the canal. And they established a very large-scale monitoring plot. One of the problems prior to this work is that tropical rainforests, I told you, they're super diverse. There are thousands of species in individual national parks, and I'll come back to that. And what they did is they established this big monitoring plot so that they could sample all of the species in very large sample sizes, in large numbers, so they could model the change through time. And since then, we've established me and my colleagues have established this Center for Tropical Forest Science, and we've established these large-scale monitoring sites in 20 countries, in 15 countries and 20 sites in representing the rainforests of the world. Asia, plenty developed. Africa, just two sites at the moment, but we're planning to expand that. And then several different places in South and Central America. And the idea behind this program is to be able to monitor and then thereby forecast what's happening to rainforests and how, you know, all these different things are playing out with real data, with very large samples that account for this extraordinary diversity. So the goal of this program, and over our first 25 years, is to document, monitor, study biodiversity in the rainforests of the world. It's a big, big goal, but it's a big program now. To monitor their long-term dynamics and try to understand why forests are changing in the various ways I mentioned earlier. To research ecological and economical means of sustainably managing these forests. All of these forests, as I pointed out before, are being impacted by people in one way or another. And we want to try to understand not just the ecology, but the economics of why and how that can be done in a sustainable way. And then finally, every one of these countries, and I'll come back to this, every one of these countries we work in, they have, in many cases, extraordinarily limited scientific capacity. And so part of our goal is to build that capacity. Next, thanks. And so just to summarize that sampling method we use a very, very large-scale plot. 50 hectares, roughly speaking, is about 120 acres in area. We sample and measure every single tree bigger than about a centimeter in diameter in that whole area. We map, we measure them, we tag them, and we remeasure them every 5 years so we know what's happening through time. And we use this in every single one of these plots. We identify them all to species, which means now in the network we have something in the order of 7,000 species of trees mapped, measured, monitored, and we're starting to be able to project what's happening to those species through time. There are about 250 tree species in the whole of North America. There are only about 100 in the whole of Europe. So this is a vast undertaking. So a 50-hectare plot, just to give you a sense of what it looks like, it's a kilometer on one side and half a kilometer on the other side, or 1,000 meters by 500 meters. And this is a map of one example species. And this is the map. These are topography lines. The green are different kinds of habitats, different soil types. And this particular species, you can see it likes to grow on the white part. It doesn't seem to grow on the green. And I'll come back to that later. So we go out in the field. It's intensive field work. It's ongoing. It's now decades of work. We put posts in the ground, and depending on the kind of forest we're in, if we have elephants in our forest, we have special tags, special posts. This one was kicked over by an elephant. We have tigers in some of the plots, so there are issues with safety as well. In fact, since somebody asked me just to tell stories while I'm going along, we did have one fatality in one of the plots, which has tigers. In India, we work in the Western Ghats in southern India, and in that forest, I'll show you a photo a little bit later of that forest, but when you go in the forest, there's very tall grass. It's quite a dry tropical forest, and there's tall grass. You have to be quite careful for both elephants and tigers. And so you have to take trackers, these very well-trained, experienced people who know how to find tigers. And unfortunately, one of the trackers trod on a sleeping tiger. It had a meal. There was a dead deer next to it. Trod on it. It turned and swiped. It broke his neck and killed him on the spot. So, yeah, there's a few risks involved in this job. So anyway, we put a paint mark around the tree so we know where we measured it. And we put a unique tag on it. I mean, it's not rocket science. Go on. But we do have lots and lots of field staff. These are students, undergrads, parataxonomists, we sometimes call them. And they're from the countries. They work. They spend months and years in the field doing this. It takes about 2 years to establish one of these plots. Many of the students who work on the projects, for example, this is Thailand. This young chap here is a master's student now, and I'm on his thesis committee, and he's been doing a project that looks at this particular flora, and they collect all the specimens. These are museum specimens. Next, please. These museum specimens get curated, we call it, museum protected, and used for future study by all kinds of different scientists. Here's an example of the field team in Congo. I was just there earlier this year. I think I was telling some of you before. This is the team who works on the recensus of the plots. So they go out and remeasure all the trees. They live in these mud huts in the field. We're in the middle of the Congo where it's 20 kilometers walk to get to the field site. It takes us a day just to walk out there. Needless to say, I don't have to carry my bag. They carry it for me, which is terrible. But anyway, that's life now. And but these guys, these are the local pygmies from that part of the Congo. They all work on the, these guys are about 4 feet tall, four and a half feet tall. They're the indigenous community from eastern Congo, and then there are the more widespread community of Congolese who are often from universities or from forestry departments. Every site we have a similar kind of team made up of local partners. This is another station which we work in Sarawak in Malaysia. That's the eastern part, Borneo. We build a field station, and some of them we can put internet in. We have satellite internet. We have, you know, all kinds of stuff. It's really can be quite luxurious. We have electricity in this one. Next. This is a difference. This is one, the one in central Amazonia, right in the middle of the Amazon, in the heart where the two rivers, the Amazon meets the Rio Negro. And we sleep in hammocks, which I find rather uncomfortable. But anyway, it's you're in there. But the beautiful thing about this, because the forest drains the Rio Negro from the Rio Negro or into the Rio Negro, there are no mosquitoes in this forest. So that's kind of a nice thing. We have all the nasties you can imagine in all these different places. So you have to watch out. But here we don't have to sleep with mosquito nets, which is quite nice. Next. So look, let's take a look and see just what this means in terms of species diversity of trees. And this is all the different plots in Asia, Latin America, and Africa, the different areas. And there are thousands of species in some of these, the really rich parts of the world. The richest parts of the tropics, the most biodiverse, and this is trees, it doesn't matter if you look at anything else, they're all the same. Ecuador, the western part of the Amazon basin, is extremely rich. And the other place is Borneo. The island of Borneo is extremely rich. The other parts of the tropics, you can see tropical forest in, say, India, for example, is very, relatively species poor, a tenth of the diversity of some of these other places. And this just shows you the hundreds of thousands of trees in each of these sites that are mapped and monitored through time. Next is just to summarize again that now, these censuses have been going on for decades in some cases, and we've done something like 56 total censuses. So now we're starting to be able to say, oh, this is have really useful information to model how these forests are changing. And there are millions, as I said before, millions of trees in the whole network. Next, please. And all this data becomes available. The policy of our program, and I mean, for science, this is a big issue, is trying to make the data available so people can use it. And particularly, we're concerned about making it available within the developing countries where we work. Next, please. And these plots have become, this is one of my colleagues in Thailand, the leader of the project there, and his students. These have become a place where, because we've put resources and facilities there, students can come in and do the projects that they like to do, and it's a safe and convenient place to work. Next. We do a lot of training. Here is the leader of the Malaysian program, the Peninsula Malaysian program. And this is a group of students who run, we have field courses, and we rotate these courses around the different countries. We bring all the students from, whether it be Latin America together, Asia together, Africa together. And that way we're creating a very, one, scientific capacity, but two, regional cooperation, which is often, believe it or not, missing in so many parts of the tropics. Next. An important part of what we do in terms of the information collection is that the data, the information is collected in a uniform way across all of the different places. And that means we can get together as a group. This is one of our workshops where we all sit with computers and we analyze all these big data sets. And people from all over the tropics are together. And the data are standardized, so it's very easy for comparisons to be made. And we've done a lot of work, and I'll show you some of the work showing how forests are changing at a global scale, which is a very important level to look at, rather than just somebody works in Somebody works in French Guiana and they talk about French Guiana. Somebody works in India, they talk about India. We can say, oh, look, this is what happens in 15 different countries. So it's a powerful tool for global analysis. Now we're working at a different level of diversity with all this new technology to do with DNA. We're working, and this is an example of high school students actually in Singapore who work. We work in some countries which are much wealthier than others, Singapore being a wealthy one. Here the students have got very excited by the idea of using DNA to identify the plants. And so we're doing all this stuff with high school students. They learn how to sequence DNA in the classrooms, but they're using the material they use is from our research sites. So that's a very, and we're doing this with butterflies and trees as well. So you may be thinking, if you've done any international work before, you may be thinking, how do you hold this thing together? How does it, what is the gel? You know, it must be easy for it to fragment, just like forests. It must be easy for it to fragment. Well, the way it happens is there's a scientist, a PhD-level scientist, who leads the project in each of the countries. This is in Brazil. This is in the middle of the Amazon. This guy is from the University of Alexandre Oliveira, his name is. He's from the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil. And he's the leader of the program. I'm not the leader of the program. I coordinate all the people who are, but he's the boss of the project. He owns the project. Very much involved. We're very much interested in local ownership and local participation. Otherwise, this thing's going to fall apart. If I, you know, me as an Aussie or an American, try to dominate and rule this thing, it'll go like every other international-led attempt at that kind of thing. So these are all, just to give you an idea, these are a list of partners in all the different countries we work. These can be forest departments, they can be universities, they can be all kinds of different institutions, national parks departments, who manage and are in charge of the resources, the forests. Next, please. So let's have a look at some of these forests just to sort of get... Have any of you been to a tropical forest? I should have asked that right at the start. Some? Oh, good. Good. So which parts of the world?
I was Thailand.
Okay. Yeah. Are you guys?
In Kerala.
In Kerala. Oh, okay. Good. Peru and... Okay, okay, lots. So what you see, if you've been to more than one, is that they're all different. They all have very different structures, and that's driven by a lot of different environmental factors and also what we call historical factors. But this is a dry end. Tropical forests can be very, very dry, for example, in India. These forests, in fact, naturally, I said wet tropical forests don't have fire, but there are dry tropical forests and they do have fire naturally. And this is an example of one. Next. These forests in India, they can have all kinds of wildlife. These particular ones in India are very, very rich in large herbivores. I mentioned tigers. They're not herbivores, they're carnivores. But elephants, various kinds of big ungulates, and these deer, spotted deer. Next. This is another one, another forest, a dry forest in northern Thailand, which would be like what you saw in Cambodia or Laos, wherever you were. These dry, open, dry forests. But they're tropical, they get a lot of rainfall. It's just that the rainfall's aggregated in a part of the year and then there's a very long dry period. Next. Then if you move into the wetter places, the total structure of the forest changes. You get lots of things like palms. This is a palm. And then permanent streams, I should say. Next forest. Yeah, so in Borneo then, the forest can be giant. The forest can vary hugely in their height. In Borneo here, they're 70 meters tall, the big trees. Next. And, of course, they have all of these forests have timber that people care about. I mentioned that already. Next. These forests also differ in the way they get affected by natural disturbances. All forests are... I mean, we know from this part of the world that occasional hurricanes will come in and knock down forest in the eastern seaboard of the USA. The same thing is true in the tropics. There are all kinds of different disturbances, natural disturbances, and we need to understand those natural disturbances, and that will help us understand these human disturbances. And this is an example from the Philippines. We work way up on the east coast of Luzon Island in the northeast of the Philippines, and this is a hill range running down here with ridges. And these ridges face the ocean, and these ridges face the inland, and that part of the Philippines gets hammered every 2 or 3 years by typhoons. And this is just after a typhoon we flew over, and you can see all these trees have no leaves, at all. They're completely defoliated, but the typhoons don't kill the trees. They just defoliate them and then the trees resprout. So we need to understand that. And our plot up there spans one of these big areas so we can look at how the natural disturbance affects the forest. Next. Okay, so what kind of science, what kinds of things are we finding out that people should care about or might care about? And we can open, this is a part of the thing I'd like to open up for discussion later. So we, first of all, there's an enormous, as you all know, there's an enormous diversity in the tropics, and a lot of it is very poorly understood. And so since the start of this program, we've described lots and lots of new and interesting plant species. Plant people who are here, this is a magnolia, this is a fig, a tropical fig. There are 800 species of figs in the tropics. We eat one fig from Europe. And this is something related to a mango. Next. So one of the first major results of this work is that now, and this is a map, this is the Barra Colorado Island, which sits in the Panama Canal. This is the plot, stylized picture of the plot in the middle there. And you can see the topography map, that's the soil map. And then these are a half a dozen different species with their distributions. And the first thing you can see is that every one of them has a slightly different distribution. Some of them are abundant, some of them are not very abundant, some of them are very, very clumped. And one of our big goals has been, and I don't want to get too much into the science, but one of our big goals has been to understand how all these huge number of species live together without, you know, out-competing each other or something. And there are all sorts of theories we've developed based on these kind of results. It's a very important thing because we want to know, if you know why a species lives where it does, then you can manage it much more effectively. For timber, say, you know, if it grows on clay soils, try to plant it on sandy soils, you probably have no luck. And that leads into this second part of understanding where trees live. This is a species I pointed out before that only lives on these very, on the white soils, the white in this case, not green, but the white soils, this is a cut through that forest. A road was built on the edge of the forest. And you can see this is shale and this is sandstone. And they produce different soils, and they produce different soils, and this one likes the soils that comes from the sandstone. And so we see all kinds of information on what we call specialization to habitats of these different species. That species, by the way, just back a second, that species, by the way, is a very, very important, economically important timber species. You might know it as a Philippine mahogany, or nowadays it's sold, the trade name is tropical hardwood or something. They probably hide the name because it's endangered species. But anyway, up until then, we had no idea what soils it preferred to live on. Next. A second big area of work we've done it's got so much media attention in the last couple of years, is this whole business of changing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. This is what the results, these are monitored, these are CO2 sensors in Hawaii that have been, these are real data, these are collected from a sensor of CO2. We know this is the truth. We understand why it flips up and down every year because of, I can tell you later, basically because of there's no leaves and then there's leaves and then there's no leaves in the temperate zone. But basically, we know very well this is going up. We also know that, as I said before, tropical vegetation holds a huge amount of carbon. Tropical net primary productivity, that's photosynthesis, that's what trees do, they take up carbon dioxide. It's a huge fraction, 35% of the total that happens in the world. And we burn, just to give you these are in something like, that we call them petagrams, they're like, I don't know, 100,000 tons or something, each one of them. But in fact, trees in the tropics take up more carbon dioxide than fossil fuels currently burning fossil fuels adds. So if we change that equation, if we remove these trees, they're not going to be taking up the carbon, which is supposedly buffering this. So the biggest question we had to start out with this was, will forests increase their carbon uptake with global change? This change is often referred to as global change. Increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, trees eat carbon dioxide, so they should take up more and they should grow faster. That's the theory. That's what, you know, people have said, that's what should happen. Because for obvious reasons, they eat it and they should grow faster. Next slide. What we've found in two places, Panama and Malaysia, is that in fact the evidence that we have today, and it's fairly slim, I'll admit, but it's all we have, is that in two places there's very strong evidence that in fact the trees are growing. This is some measure of growth or carbon uptake. The trees are actually declining through time in their growth rates, which is sort of bad news. Because the elevated carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we would like it if the ecosystems were sucking it up. Because it's extra carbon dioxide, as you know, in the atmosphere is going to increase temperatures. Increasing temperatures is going to change a lot of other things. And the reason we think this pattern is occurring is because over this period, there's been an increase in temperature. And photosynthesis in plants, I'd be happy to talk in detail about this if you like, but photosynthesis in plants is very sensitive to temperature. And we think the reason they're not, the curves should be like that from first principles, but they're like that. We think maybe the reason is that temperature is at a sort of optimum, and it's pushing over that optimum. Next. The next thing I want to talk a little bit about, and I'm just touching on some of the science, and I can give you references. There are hundreds of papers on all this kind of work. I'm just touching on some of what I think are the key elements. One is discovering diversity. I mentioned that. Second one is understanding where these trees live and why. The third one is understanding climate change. And the fourth one I want to talk about is understanding forest fragmentation. And I mentioned this is the Amazon. This is an experiment, actually, we're doing in the Amazon where this is a big area of the Amazon right in the center of Brazil. And we cut this, actually. This is not this is an artificial fragment. This is what happens when farmers go in and farm their land. But we made an experiment where we just cut all the trees down. We got cows in there to eat all the grass, and we cut all the regeneration because we wanted to know what happens under those circumstances. So we could say the original idea was, what is the minimum area that we can protect? What should be the minimum park size, for example? And this is the design of it. It's down the bottom. You don't need to worry about it, but that's the point. Next. And so we did a similar thing. I won't present the results from that study because they're the same as this other study. This is a project in Singapore that our staff in Singapore are doing. Singapore is a tiny little island. Has anyone been there? It's about 650 square kilometers. It's tiny. I don't think it's much smaller than Rhode Island, much. Their only national park here. This is an aerial photograph taken in 1950. This was all deforested. There were a lot of reasons for that, agriculture and so on, the Brits principally. And we set up a plot there to try to understand what was happening to this forest fragment. The forest fragment is only 68 hectares in area, so it's tiny. It would fit on your lawn out here. No, not quite, but it's probably about as big as the cam. I don't know how big in comparison to UVA, but anyway, it's a small area. It's a kilometre by a kilometre in area, basically. And so we set it up with the idea of trying to understand what happens to trees that are in that fragment. Do they survive well? Do they die poorly or whatever? And this is it. This is the mortality, mortality tree death rates for that Singapore project plot compared to two in continuous forest, not fragments, in Malaysia, two other of our big plots. And what we saw immediately was that the death rates of these trees were 50% higher than the intact forests. So there appears to be, over a long period of time, a lot of mortality in the fragment.
Now, is this over a period
of time, or is this one year? No, this is a period of 10 years, and this is an annualized, percent per year mortality rate, and compared to the similar periods for the other two plots. So this, if you flick back, this is only 2 hectares in area. This is a small plot. We were just testing the water with this study at the time. 2 hectares is a very small area in a tropical rainforest. So we wanted to, we feel a little next. When we told this to the National Parks administrators in Singapore, they got very worried. They said, our forest is falling apart. It's their only national park. They have, amazingly, 400,000 visitors to this national park every year. Yosemite gets millions, but that, for a 68-hectare park, That is absolutely phenomenal. So it's a very, very... The population of Singapore is only 4 million. They have 400,000 visitors. There are obviously many repeats. But we told them, oh, your mortality rates in your forest are very unusually high. They said, well, what are we going to do about it? We've got to do something about it. Excuse me, did I swear on the... beep that out. Anyway, so these are extremely high mortality rates. And so they asked us to go on. And they said, well, look, we need you to do an expanded study, more like our normal ones, the very big scale plots. So we got a whole lot of students involved, Singaporean students, to measure all the big trees, because we wanted to know, are these big trees dying for some reason? There's good reasons why they might die. I mean, the park is very close to the center of Singapore City. And if Singapore is a very hot and bustling city. Next. And so we mapped all these trees, and this is a map of the whole park, and every single tree we mapped and tagged. There were 10,000 trees, just the big trees. And we found some 400 species in 150 hectares. Next. 416 species, that's more than North America. So this tiny little park in the middle of Singapore is a valuable conservation. However, when we looked carefully at the species that were there, and really this is just a map of there were primary forest species, secondary forest species, and degraded land species. The important point is here. Of those 400 species, 120 of them, close to 120 of them, had only one or two individuals in the species in the park. So that means they're very, very rare. And there's how do they reproduce? The populations are not viable with just two individuals or one individual. Many plants don't... They have gender separated, just like we do. Their genders are separated in plants, and so if there's one individual, they can't reproduce. So their populations are going to go extinct. It's just a matter of time. And many of them just have one or two individuals. And so this is really quite an important finding, and we're doing a lot of work with them to think about how to protect the buffer zone around the national park. Amra. Yeah, sure, yeah. In this place, in fact, yes, there is a lot of... So we've got constant watch out for when these trees flower. It's the idea being if they fruit, we'll culture their fruit. In fact, the National Parks Department in Singapore has got very motivated about this. They're worried about loss of species. It's well known from the island of Singapore that over the last 100 years, they've lost something like 50% of their animal species. All the major animals, all the big animals have gone. Their rats have become domestic rats, not native rats, and all kinds of stuff. I mean, it's really an important thing. And so, yes, you can do it either through tissue culture or you can do it through taking the seeds. At the moment, we're trying to get seeds for them. And this is an example of the buffer zone area around the park. And we've got Singapore's a wealthy society, so volunteer work can happen in such a society. And we've got all kinds of help working to cut these weeds away and plant native species in the perimeter. Next. And that leads me on to a big project we have in Panama. I just want to mention it. We understand something about the science of these trees growing in forest, intact forest. Yeah, please. Yeah, very good question. Very good question, and I skipped over that. We only tag big trees meaning in 30 centimeters or... There are two people hanging out the window. You can come in. Please come in. Thought for a minute they were checking the facts of my seminar. Yeah, it's a good question. So... You're absolutely right. There may well be juveniles, small trees, saplings or whatever, of those species that are not in our class. The class we defined as a big tree is 30 centimeters in diameter. So that's about that big. Those trees are typically in the canopy. But you're absolutely right. There could be lots in the understory. So what we're trying to find out now is by doing sub-sampling of the small plants to find out what's there. But it's a very good point. It's almost certainly the case that many of them are rare, even in the small classes. because small plant, I can talk to you later about why. Okay, so then that the restoration program, we, as part of our CTFS's program, we have an applied ecology group as well, and this is all about trying to understand how, okay, now you've got a piece of degraded land, and it's in a rainforest area, how do you restore it? How do you go, what would you do? About 75% of the restoration, we call it restoration in the tropics, that means going out and trying to recreate a forest, about 75% of it is done with non-native species. So it's done with things like teak or eucalyptus or acacia from Australia. But this doesn't recreate an ecosystem because then none of the animals that are in that area eat those plants, naturally feed on them. So we've been doing a big, big experiment, sets of experiments to try to understand how we grow these in the open in open pastures, in open degraded land. And my colleague, in fact, interestingly, my colleague, he's the director of our applied ecology program. His name is Jefferson Hall. And he... No, it's true. It's true. It's absolutely true. And but the interesting thing was, and I challenge, well, maybe some of you know, maybe I was talking to somebody today, Bailey's father is a horticulturalist, and so she may know, but I wonder how many of you know what the plant Jeffersonia is. Homework for the society, I think. Anyway, there is a plant called Jeffersonia, and it was named after him, of course, and it is growing, I believe, although this is my first time in this area. I know it is growing in the how do you say it? Monticello. Okay, next. That was an aside. And the final project I want to talk about is... I've been going on for ages, it feels... No. The final thing I want to talk about is then why to... It's about what is the value of forest at all? I mean, okay, you got back to the issue of what I were calling ecosystem services at the start of the talk, is that, you know, they control hydrology, they control carbon sequestration, these kind of things. How do we quantify that? How do we put economics on that as well? And what we've done is we're initiating is a very large experiment in the Panama Canal Zone. This is the Panama Canal, as you probably know, was built around just shortly after the turn of the century, the turn of the last century. This is the Pacific coast. It runs through about 80 miles or so across the canal, across the Isthmus of Panama into the Caribbean. It currently is a very, very important economic resource, not only for Panamanians, but for all of us. The U.S. intermodal system, that's the system where transportation goes from Asia to California and across the land of North America to the Pacific side, so New York and all the markets on the East Coast. The U.S. intermodal system currently takes about 60%. That means the across land is about 60% of that freight. The Panama Canal takes about 40% of that, and you can go the other way around the world through the Suez if you want, but not many people do. But this is going to be expanding, and this figure is an underestimate again. The amount the Panama Canal takes is going to greatly increase because the Panama Canal is currently being widened. They're building a third set of locks. This is the locks, and if you ever get to Panama, Smithsonian, part of our facility is in Panama. It's just an extraordinary thing to look at, and the history of the Panama Canal is a wonderful thing to read. But anyway, these locks, they shift the ships come up and down. It's wonderful. And they, next thing. Okay, so the Panama Canal relies on water, no surprise. They need water to lift the ships up. And the water comes from this giant lake called Gatun Lake. The Gatun Lake was formed by damming here and damming in several places here and here and creating locks and blocking the water, which was coming down from the Chagres River. This river runs into here, and all these watersheds, and the whole Panama Canal watershed is this giant area which flows all the rainfall in the rainforest into this lake, and that provides the water, one, for the canal, two, for the drinking water of Panama City, three, for the, and the other cities, and three, for the for hydropower on the dams. So this is an amazing thing. 275 million metric tons of cargo per year go through the Panama Canal both ways. Every ship that goes through requires 200,000 cubic meters of water. Cubic meter is about, you know, of water, 200,000 of them times however many ships. And they're functioning every day and every night, 24/7 throughout the year. So this is a vast amount of water. Next. So the Panama, just to reiterate that, the Panama Canal provides drinking water, transport, energy. The forest presumably has some effect in taking up carbon because there's rural livelihoods. The canal zone, the watershed, is heavily deforested. There's another person at the window. Come in. Come in. Feel free to come in. And then, so that's the, here's a picture with the green of the water, of the canal's watershed. So all this area is functioning as a watershed. It's dribbling water down into the canal. Next. But the canal zone, the watershed, is very close to Panama City, and it's very close to a couple of other big cities, and there's vast deforestation. And there's farmlands. This is the landscape. If you fly over it in a helicopter, the landscape's heavily deforested, cattle ranching's widespread. Next, please. And the number of people living in the canal zone is dramatically increasing every year, and these people are mostly poor. And so they're subsistence, and so they're farming, they're cutting down trees.
Is that why people are moving in there? Is it
very... Sure. The land is arable, as is much of the Isthmus of Panama. It's not fabulous land, but it's quite good cattle ranching land. And it's proximity to cities and jobs and other things that people come to cities for. However, there are two important other threats to the canal. One is drought. Panama gets occasionally these ENSO events, these El Nino events, and they cause severe droughts. These are so severe in some cases that the canal, the lake, Gatun Lake, can dry up considerably. That can cost the government millions and billions, actually, of dollars because they have to transport the cargo across by freight trains. There's a freight train that runs east, north-south across. The second major issue is flooding. Floods will come in and you can imagine that these locks have a lot of expensive and sensitive equipment that maintain the water levels. They've got to predict how much water's in the locks. They'll let a little bit out. In case there's a storm, they'll let a little bit more out. And they've got to regulate the locks so that through the dry season, they have enough water to maintain freight traffic. And so flooding can be an enormous cost as well as drought. And so the question is, what does forest help? Next. So what we're doing, we've just started this, is, and Jefferson Hall is the main man behind this, is we've got in the catchment of the canal, we've set up a very big experiment. These are big patches. Of, I don't know if there's a... Yeah, so these are big. This is a kilometre. The scale here is a kilometre. And these are big pieces of land which are watersheds. These watersheds are properties which we've been in the process of trying to buy and through a whole series of partnerships we can talk about if you like. And these are watersheds that are outside the national park. And these are little sub-catchments, we call them. Little parts of the watershed. And each one of these is used, is variously degraded. Some of them are completely barren. Some of them have this very bad invasive grass. And some of them, these catchments in here, are perfectly pristine forest. And so what we're doing is we're setting up an experiment to monitor exactly what happens throughout the years, and hopefully through a drought event, as to what happens to the water flows, what happens to the carbon flows, what happens to the quality of the water. If you're farming cattle on these and they're crapping into the catchments, what happens to the quality of the water? Does it matter? And so this experiment's just getting underway, but I think it'll get... We have the advantage in this situation, the economists among you will recognize it. We know how much a milliliter of water costs. We know the value of the ecosystem service, which is very hard to do when you think about aesthetic values of forests. How do I quantify how much you care about forests? I mean, you like forests, you walk in them once every few weeks, once every month, once every 6 months maybe. How do I economically value that? And it's a big old problem. But in this case, we can value it very accurately because we know exactly what the Panama Canal Authority has to pay if they don't have water or conversely for drinking water. So this experiment was being set up now, and we've got hydrologists and foresters all involved. And one of the things we'll be doing is reforesting some of these very degraded catchments with native species to understand what that means as well. I think I might have... Oh, the only thing I was going to say to end was that this network of large-scale plots, it's a growing enterprise, and we're now looking at sites. Actually, in Maryland is one of the sites where we're working now. Up in Harvard Forest, we're working in the UK, we're working in southern South America as well, because there's been a lot of interest in asking, well, now, okay, you've got this great network of sites in the tropics, how does that compare to the temperate zone? And so we're doing that kind of work. I think I will... There are a few more slides, but I think I'll finish there. I'm running out of steam. Thank you.
You can answer any questions.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to answer questions, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming and speaking tonight. I actually had two questions. First,
sure.
Are you exploring at all the remnants of the Atlantic forest in Brazil?
Yeah.
And then second, how is it possible to restore some of these forests that have such incredible species diversity?
Yeah, it's a good two questions. The first one is, yes, the Sao Paulo area. So somebody was asking me before, I think it was you, or somebody was asking me before about what are Atlantic coastal forests. Think of a map of South America. In fact, there is one here. South America, the Amazon basin is... So the Andes... Oh, this whole thing will collapse. The Andes run, as you know, down the east coast. Down the west coast of South America. The Amazon basin drains everything east of the Andes, and so the Amazon basin is this giant area here. It's an enormous 7 million square kilometer area. It's just totally fascinating. It is a basin, like a basin. It is flat and it slopes very, very gradually east west, west east. If you're here in this place in Amakayaku, it's an unbelievable thing, but you are 150 meters above sea level. 150 meters. So over 2,500 miles to the Atlantic, and I'm getting off the point, you go down 150 meters. Anybody, mathematicians here will be able to help. 2,500 miles with 150 meter decline. Amazingly gradual basin. Anyway, so the Amazon basin's all here. The southern rim of the Amazon is all dry. It goes into a vegetation called cerrado, and various other kinds of dry vegetation, dry forests. But there's a piece of forest which runs all the way down as far as Argentina, which is called the Atlantic Coastal Forest. It's wet. It gets affected by coastal rains. Orographic rainfall comes off the ocean. And it's very, very wet, and it goes down 2,000 miles. It's very different from place to place. We're very interested, and we're starting a project down here with Earthwatch International. Some of you may know Earthwatch. Down here in the area of Sao Paulo, actually, Sao Paulo's here, I think. In the area of Sao Paulo, just south of Sao Paulo, in some of this really unique forest. It's like 80% unique species. It's a very unique place, and it's highly fragmented on account of history of extraction of Brazil wood. Brazil's named after a wood, in case you didn't know. And that wood has been heavily extracted from the Atlantic coastal forests. The second question was...
How do you feel about restoring forests that have such
a... Yeah, so it just... One of the key things about how... It's a complicated question. If you're near a piece of intact forest with what we call mother trees, so trees of native species that are producing offspring, seeds, and you're within reach of that area, all you've got to do is keep fire and humans out. I mean, if you want the forest to come back. I mean, it's always much more complicated than that. But it will come back. Seeds will get dispersed in. Different kinds of species, pioneers like birches and things will come in. Underneath that, the heavier hardwoods, the more valuable timbers, they'll germinate. That's possible. If you excuse me, if you're in the middle of nowhere and you're not near mother trees or you're not near an intact forest, you have to plant them. And so how do you go about that? What people tend to do is they take things like figs, which I mentioned, which are very important food plants in the tropical rainforest. They're food plants for birds and small mammals and bats and things. People tend to plant those. We sometimes call them, you might have heard of them as keystone species. They're species which a lot of animals feed on, but the animals also feed on other things. So they'll feed on the figs, they'll crap the seeds, they'll go back to the forest, could be hundreds of miles away, they'll pick up other seeds and they'll bring them out and they'll similarly dump them in the area. And so there could be a succession going on. The problem is that it's very difficult to keep fire out, it's very difficult to keep other kinds of disturbances out, and often many political issues become important. It's very hard to keep people out, it's very hard to keep not just poor people out because they want to farm, but it's very hard to keep rich people out because they want to develop. And so then, if you don't have, governments will respond if you say, well, this is the only spotted tortoise in Brazil occurs here. People will say, oh, we can protect this area. But if you say, well, there's nothing there, it's degraded, burned farmland, how are you going to preserve it?
Thank you for your fascinating discussion. I've seen before sort of an S-curve in terms of the prosperity of a nation or more highly developed nations and pollution. And you noted that one of the important things you want to identify is how economics is impacting this.
Yeah.
You're analyzing so many different sites with so many different economies. How does poverty or prosperity impact the rainforest degeneration?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and it's something that environmental economists have done a lot of work on and continue to do a lot of work on. To be frank, it's not my field, but it's not the case that the poorest countries clear their forests the quickest. It's not the case. There are, and I'll just give you anecdotes. That's the only way I can answer that question, really. I do a lot of work in Sri Lanka, which is a country which is per capita income is extremely low. It's one of the lowest in South Asia and Southeast Asia. It has ongoing civil war, which it's had for the last 45 years or something. People are largely subsistence, or the cash crops, tea and rubber being the main ones. People have an extraordinary regard for conservation. People are a protected area is a protected area. They will not, they'll collect non-timber forest products, things like jaggery, the sweet, what's it called? The palm sugar. They'll collect things like that from the forest, but they won't kill the animals. They're Buddhists, so religion comes into it. They won't go into a forest and hunt it. Thailand is a much wealthier country than Sri Lanka. Thailand, hunting is an enormous problem. Deforestation is an enormous problem, so much so that the Thai government has put a moratorium on all logging. So it's not the case that, in answer to your question, it's not the case that the poorest countries deforest the quickest. The poorest of the poorest countries, in fact, the Democratic Republic of the Congo has the second biggest piece of tropical rainforest in the world outside of Brazil, the Congo Basin. That is largely intact. It's 80% or 85% intact. The reason for that is those people are poorer than anybody else in the world almost. The reason that's still intact is because of war, genocide in eastern Congo and Rwanda and Burundi. That forest is, there's no way to get into it. There are no roads. There's no infrastructure. So with prosperity will come an enormous deforestation of the African Congo Basin, I predict. And when I was there recently, it was true enough. There were, in this case, Chinese developers building a road from the eastern Congo across to Kisangani on the Congo River, and the idea being is to extract resources, not just timber, but minerals and so on. Then the wealthier countries, you move up into, say, and I'm talking about Asia because I know it the best. You move into countries like Malaysia, a very wealthy country. Now it's got a growing a small population, 25 million, fairly wealthy economy, prosperous economy, high levels of literacy, high levels of education. You have a growing environmental awareness. And then you move that one a step further and you have Singapore, who is probably wealthier than us now, per capita wise, extremely concerned about conservation, but got nothing left to conserve. So that's a complicated one. There are economists in here. You can probably comment. Next.
Thank you again for coming. And you spoke earlier about how the heating is affecting the way trees are growing. And do you know if there's any research done to what aspect of the photosynthetic process is affected, or do you know that?
There is a lot of experimental work going on with model systems. Model systems are ones we grow in chambers or we grow in closed environments so we can really understand how they work. There's a lot known about the sensitivity of the different enzymes in the photosynthetic process to a pathway to temperature. I can lead you to that information if you like. That's never been done in the field, though. It's a very difficult thing to control temperature for a tree. In fact, funnily enough, we did try, for another reason. We had an undergrad go out to Borneo one year. We have a canopy walkway in one of the forests, and there's always been some talk about temperature signals to flowering. I mentioned that flowering behavior every 5 years in Borneo. Well, some people have said, it could be temperature that's cueing the trees to flower. So we had this student. She was very, very ambitious. She climbed up into the trees and took air conditioning units, and we wired all the way up into the forest, and she tried to cool these branches down. We encased these branches in giant balloons, filled them with cold air, and tried to induce flowering. And then we used the trees didn't flower, but we used genetic probes to see if the genes that are involved in flowering got turned on. And she didn't find anything, but it was... it was just way too ambitious. Next, yeah.
I just returned a few weeks ago from the Southern Pantanal in Brazil,
on Earthwatch. Yeah.
It was fantastic. So I can actually ask you if there were any opportunities like Earthwatch to do this. And it's a wonderful way to take a trip. You can easily fit it into a vacation, a school trip. So I think Earthwatch.org, the color of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Earthwatch is all over the place, as you say. Earthwatch and CTFS, that's our group. WWF, World Wildlife Fund, and a policy group in the United Kingdom called the Climate Group, who does a lot of industry-level stuff to do with climate change. The four of us have just gotten involved in a partnership with HSBC Bank, the big Hong Kong, the London-based Hong Kong Shanghai Bank, to do long-term studies. The watershed study I just described to you was part of that program, funded by HSBC Bank to do various kinds of studies on climate change. Earthwatch is very much involved in that, and we have Earthwatch partnering with Earthwatch in just here in Maryland. I always say Maryland. I don't know how you say it. I can't say it correctly. Oxford in the UK, South America with Earthwatch, and you can look on their website, look on our website, and you'll find that information. Yeah. The back. Oh, you with the bow tie.
Oh, yes. Thank you.
Elegant bow tie, I should say.
I was wondering, you said you're working in Maryland, looking at more temperate deciduous forests. Are you finding that they're fairly well managed? Because the CO2 curve you showed, and you said the oscillation had to do with the leaf drop, the magnitude of the oscillation didn't seem to shift at all along the curve.
Yeah, that's a good question. What the signal is just a seasonal signal. I don't think you would expect over 20 years, 20 or is it four, even 40 years? And in the temperate zone, there's been a gradual, in North America, there's been a gradual reforestation or afforestation. The forest cover of North America has steadily increased over the last 150 years, actually. But that's not true in Northern Europe, and particularly the boreal zone has been. There are lots of parts of the boreal zone that are being cut down. That signal, all it's showing you is that there's every year when the leaves drop in the winter, the trees are respiring, but they're not fixing carbon dioxide. Yeah, and it just... Does that answer your question?
I guess what I was asking is the magnitude's not changing. It would seem like the total number of trees in the world isn't necessarily changing.
It's a north temperate effect, not a total tropical effect. Yeah. It's not a global effect. It's only measured in the one Mauna Loa site. We could afterwards, maybe.
Thank you again for your speech. Could the problem of reforestation be solved if the rest of the world did treat forests like the United States, where you cut a tree down and plant one back because it's a resource for us? I mean, is the rest of the world following that motto, or is it...
That's a good, interesting question. I'm not sure that's true in the U.S. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't think, if you go out to the northwest, that's true. I mean, trees, they're not, certainly not replacing the carbon that's standing there. I mean, obviously, they're planting small trees. It's not religiously followed. The afforestation that's happening in North America is natural regeneration after abandonment of farmlands. Yeah, that's not. Yeah. The other thing you have to remember too is economies of things like timber don't work at a national scale. They work at an international scale. How much of the timber? I mean, China, for example, produces almost no timber of its own. But it's the biggest consumer of tropical timbers at the moment. So you can't, the U.S. is also a big consumer of tropical timbers. Is the U.S. planting to offset? Is Australia doing the same thing? I mean, I'm not making a particular comment about a country, but I'm just making the general point is that you've got to view that commodity in a larger context. Sure. Any more?
Thank you very much for your presentation. I was just wondering, from a political standpoint, you mentioned several sites and also one of the Singapore-based, you said that the government there is particularly responsive, but in countries like India and Brazil where they do have significant development concerns, how responsive have you found government agencies to concerns that you probably have raised regarding the tropical forest?
It's a very variable thing, and there's no single country government position on most of these things, except if it's going to give them bad press, avoid it at all costs. But, we have very receptive ministers in different countries we work who are really excited by what we're doing. Singapore, I think, to be fair, the higher administration just wants to deal with it, keep it out of our public profile. We had an interesting case, and it's published in the journal Science over the last... I could dig out the article if you're interested, about a case in Brazil. I showed you that map of that fragmentation experiment we're doing in Brazil. I didn't talk about the experiment, but I just showed you the map. That area is owned by a development agency, a Brazilian development agency, and they've been actively trying to migrate farmers in to this land. We know, ecologists have known for a long time, that land is among the most unproductive land in the world, in the tropics, among the most unproductive land. You can grow crops on it for 1 year. You can probably grow cattle at very low densities for a few years. But they're continuing to do this. And it's moving into an area where we, in partnership with a Brazilian research institution, the Amazonian Research Institute, have this big long-term research project. And so they, the Brazilians who lead the project, again, that's an important distinction between whether I lead it or whether my colleagues lead it or whether the Brazilians lead it. The Brazilians have gone to various ministers and said, look, this is a travesty. You can't move. And the people they're moving in are not peasants for the most part. They're mostly moderately affluent city people who have weekend farm kind of activities going on. So the Brazilians responded, the researchers, and they're politically very active in general, the Brazilians. They approached various agencies, and there's a big all-out fight about this. And it was published in the journal Science just recently, an article from the Brazilian and my colleague Bill Lawrence at the Smithsonian, pointing out that this was just an unsustainable development. The development was not for the people who need the development, and the Brazilians are backing off. I mean, the politicians are backing off, but you couldn't do that in many countries. You could not fight head on. They would take another case where I've worked a lot in the state of Sarawak in East Malaysia. If we raise an issue like that, they'll kick us out. They would take no. I mean, we wouldn't 5 seconds of our time, and they'd say, "See you later." So you pick your fights in that sort of world.
How much is the demand for beef causing?
I don't know the answer to that, other than to say that it's not an issue in South and Southeast Asia. I mean, there's no cattle production outside of... There's a little bit in the Philippines, which results in deforestation, but Philippines has only got about 8% of its forest cover anyway. The case of Brazil, the big concern everybody has right now is soybeans and biofuel. There's a lot of discussion, I don't know if you follow it in the news, there's a lot of discussion about sugarcane and other potential biofuels. Brazil is ahead of everybody in the amount of motor vehicle gas that's generically that's produced from ethanol and other sources. And there's a whole lot of hope that the Brazilians will, among Brazilians, that they'll be the leaders in the biofuel industry. But it means growing and probably deforesting. Because at the moment they can't use wood, they have to use just sugar and things like that. Any more? Anyway.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
Pleasure.